We're waiting for duplicating to bring everything up here. They made a mistake, I guess, and ran the wrong stuff. And apparently we have a new rule around here. We are supposed to announce this is the Senate Finance Committee and that a quorum's present because something's going on the tape or something. And so I think what we'll do is maybe we'll just go around, each meeting will go around the table, and everybody can say this is the Senate Finance Committee and there's a quorum present.
Say their name.
There's an idea. I don't know, are we doing that? Are we supposed to do that with all committees? Do all chairmen have to do that? Or just me?
No,
just you. All right, so does everybody understand that? This is the Senate Finance Committee.
And what's the date?
Well, then I'm in the wrong place.
Do I have to say the date?
Yeah, you have to say the date.
Yes.
Yeah, then I'm in the wrong place.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Westrum.
It's kind of like when you get on a flight, they announce where you're going, so at least if you're in the wrong spot, you can get off before they go.
Sometimes they don't do
okay,
that.
Well, Senator Fischbach made that clear. So,
all right, so you could have that problem.
I'm told we're going to have everything here, and what we've wanted to do each year is to get a sense of the forecast, where we're going. And this is actually the first opportunity for Commissioner Franz to appear in front of the real money committee as opposed to what you previously did. So, Commissioner, it's
real money.
Nice to have you here.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the invitation. It's great to be here. I've had an opportunity to work with you in the last 4 years, and with many of the members of this committee I've got to know and work with as well, so it's a great opportunity to be here in this new capacity. I'm honored to be here by the governor's choice. But I do wanted to introduce my colleagues with me. I've got Laura Kalamakaitis, the state economist, with me on my left. And I've got Margaret Kelly, the budget director, assistant commissioner, on my right. And also John Pollard, the liaison and communications guru from the department, is here somewhere in the back. But we're really happy to be here and glad to prepare some information about the November forecast. And shall we just jump right in, Mr. Chair?
Yes, we delayed the start of the committee in the hopes we'd have this, and I'm told it's 2 minutes. So why don't you begin, and then we can catch up with the material. I apologize to committee members and didn't realize we'd have trouble with this. So, Commissioner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things we'd like to talk about in the initial part of this presentation is the comparison of the current fiscal year 14-15, and the new fiscal year coming up 16 and 17. So the first thing that I'd like to talk a little bit about is what happened with the November forecast with respect to the current fiscal year 2014-2015. And one of the things that we found is that we had higher revenues than originally anticipated, but also lower spending. So the result of that was we generated about $556 million forecast balance for this fiscal year ending on June 30, 2015. The increased projected balance for the biennium, as I mentioned, is $556 million. The forecast revenues increased by $279 million, and the projected spending decreased by $250 million. So one of the nice opportunities that we have is when you couple the projected forecast balance and available balance for 2014-2015, that sets the stage for the new projection for 2016-2017. Now, one of the important items that we want to mention is the fact that the new law passed requires that one-third of the forecast balance in November must be put to the reserve. So the new law directs $183 million to the budget reserve, leaving $373 million available balance for fiscal year 14-15 as we move into this budget cycle for the next biennium. The changes to the law requires that 33% of any forecast balance for the current biennium for 2014-2015 determined each November is to be deposited to the reserve balance until recommended levels are reached. So with that 33% requirement, we added $183 million to the budget. Now, the forecast for 2016 and 2017 shows a slightly different picture. And so what we're seeing with the forecast for 2016-2017 is that when you take this balance that's available from the current biennium and you add it to the forecast balance going forward, we have a projected available balance of a little over $1 billion, so $1,037,000,000. Now, the 2016-2017 forecast shows that revenues are forecast to be $41.8 billion, which is 4.8% above the 2014-2015 biennium. Now, the spending is $41.2 billion, 4.8% above the projected forecast for 14 and 15. So we're seeing some the revenues are going to be declining somewhat from projections, but still increasing over the prior biennium. Spending will be decreasing as well, although still somewhat above the prior biennium. So the $337 million ending balance that I just mentioned for 2015 now adds to the beginning resources for the next biennium. This results in the $1.037 billion balance that now is expected for 2016 and 2017. This is up from a $603 million projection that we had at the end of session just this last year. Now, one of the things that we want to note in the $1 billion available for the upcoming fiscal 2016-2017 budget is that this will increase the reserves now to a total of $1.344 billion. This is the largest reserve that we've had, and it provides an opportunity for us to go forward with an increased reserve as well as an available balance of over $1 billion as we enter this budget cycle. This particular November forecast clearly sets the stage for this session, and obviously in the end of February, when we have the new February forecast, that will be the final numbers that we will work with the governor and with the legislature to put together the final budget for the next biennium. But I think it's important to remember that we've made some significant changes, and we're sitting in a situation where we can work with a projected balance as opposed to a projected deficit. But with the good news in terms of the increase in the budget reserve and the increase in the available balance, we do have some economic news that Dr. Colin Mikaitis would like to describe to you as we go forward as well.
Dr. Colin Mikaitis, and members, again, I'm sure hoping we get the material. So I don't know if you didn't have slides you were going to show us, did you? Or
the slides are the print handouts that you're going to get.
So I don't know if you.
I can describe what it is that you would be looking at if you had it in front of you.
Soon, I hope.
Sure, that's fine. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. So we're casting back to the November forecast and describing, at that point, we were describing the difference between the U.S. economic outlook at the time we completed the February forecast, between the time we completed the February forecast and the time we completed the November one. And the U.S. outlook for economic growth weakened between the time that our budget and economic forecast was prepared last February and the most recent forecast in November 2014. You may remember, looking back to a whole year ago, that the U.S. economy had a bad start to 2014. We had an unusually harsh winter, and that temporarily slowed consumer spending, factory production, and housing. That slow start, if you remember back a year ago, the U.S. economy actually had a contraction in the first quarter of calendar year 2014. That brought the whole year down, even though growth did pick up for the rest of the year. And currently, the second quarter real GDP growth was about 4.6%. Third quarter, the revised estimate is 5.0% for the third quarter. So looking at the difference between last February and last November, consumer spending, business investment, and investment in housing all contributed less to GDP in the November forecast, U.S. macro forecast, than in the February forecast. Regarding housing investment, a surprisingly slow rate of household formation which helps drive the demand for housing. So household formations drive the demand for housing. Over the past year, helped explain a more protracted slowdown in the housing recovery. So housing formations from March 2013 to March 2014 were well below the average of the prior 2 years and well below the long-term trend. So while that wasn't good news, it was welcome news in the sense that it helped explain the fact that the housing recovery had stalled. So the on the chart that we normally show here is shows the real U.S. Real GDP growth, the annual percentage change. This is a forecast by our macroeconomic forecaster, IHS Economics, which is just changing the name from Global Insight. And the forecast in November for U.S. real GDP growth for 2014 was 2.2%. For 15, 2.6%, and for 16, 2.8%. All of those are down from what we had seen their forecast in February. February, they had forecast 2.7% for 2014, 3.3% for 2015, 3.4% for 2016. So on that chart, you would see this slight acceleration of growth, so growth picking up over time, but at a lower level than what we had expected in February. Another thing to notice about this forecast is that when you do get the chart, you'll see that we've drawn a horizontal line on the chart at 3.1% annual real GDP growth. And what that 3.1% is the 20-year average real GDP growth prior to the Great Recession. So the story I'm the picture I'm trying to draw here is that prior to the Great Recession, we had reason to expect about 3.1% growth annually for U.S. real GDP. After the Great Recession, the expectations are lower. And so the forecast now for real GDP growth, there we go. That's the bar chart is what we're looking at. So it's chart 1, 2, 3, 4, 6. Chart 6. So if you look at that dotted horizontal line on that page, you'll note that in February, we had real GDP growth expectations coming up above that level. And that's what IHS Economics had typically done, was bring real GDP growth above that 20-year average. But now the forecast does not bring us above that average. And so the sort of new normal, expecting lower U.S. growth going forward is a situation. That's the situation that we're in now. We're not seeing the forecast going up above that. Since November, however, and I'll talk about this a little bit more in a minute, IHS Economics has increased their forecast for U.S. real GDP growth somewhat to the point where in 2017 they do get us up to that 3.1%. So despite the fact that the outlook for U.S. growth weakened between February and November, economic conditions do support increased business investment, which can improve productivity and subsequently an acceleration in wages, in wage growth. Already, labor market slack is being steadily taken up in the U.S. economy by improved demand, as employment growth averaged 229,000 net new jobs a month in 2014, and the jobless rate is now down to 5.8%, a post-recession low. Yep, so you can turn to the Minnesota economic expansion continues, and I'll move to Minnesota in a minute, but that chart does show the U.S. unemployment rate there. And I'll talk about that bit more.
Paul Makitas, if I can ask. IHS, I think you mentioned, changed, the third quarter to 5%? Is that correct?
That was BEA. So okay. The Bureau of Economic Analysis.
I'm sorry, not IHS.
Revised, yeah.
So that was changed upward.
Yeah.
Any sense of what happens with the fourth quarter in terms of what, you know, Christmas sales were like or?
Yeah, they have the fourth quarter at 2.6%. So a lower quarter over quarter or annual year over year growth.
Any sense that that might be changed? Any newer information that might come in?
It's almost certainly will be changed. I think that may be the first estimate and they get three estimates. So whether, but I don't have any information about whether that's going to go up or down.
Okay, and then IHS changed. I noted in the revenue report.
Yes.
That was issued. IHS had, and you just mentioned this, had changed. Was it the first three quarters of for 15 up by about a tenth, 0.2%?
Yes. So IHS now expects real GDP growth to be at about 2.6% for the fourth quarter, an improvement from the 2.0% that they had expected in November. So that was that's the fourth quarter.
And I know I'm interrupting you, and I apologize, but I'm just trying to get a sense of where the numbers might lead us, because the revenue figure in terms of receipts showed an increase of about $212 million, and that was
correct.
Revenue, not spending.
Yep.
But would the expectation be that a March forecast might show a change relative to receipts for on a retrospective basis as opposed to in the future? But that's kind of a one-time bump that would be reflected for this current biennium, but not necessarily reflected in future bienniums. The next biennium?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. So, jumping ahead a bit, we're talking about the November forecast, but since November, we have released our quarterly revenue and economic update for January, which we released on January 10th, and we released figures showing comparing receipts. Tax receipts to the November forecast. And at that, so on November 10th, our report showed that Minnesota net general fund receipts during the months of November and December, so since the forecast, were $212 million more than projected in the November forecast. And net receipts for all major tax types were up. The individual income tax provided the largest amount, which was $166 million for the period. However, most of this was an individual income tax story, and most of that we think is timing. And so what we think is happening based on the information that we have right now is that when you combine December and January receipts and the timing issues that occur toward the end of the calendar year are resolved, that a lot of that is going to be offset by lower receipts coming in another month or so. So, yes, we do report receipts ahead of the November forecast, but we think that some or all of that is going to be washed by timing issues. So the $212 million, I wouldn't attribute to economic factors at this point, if that's what your question was.
So for our purposes, and again, sorry for interrupting, that would suggest that if hypothetically a March forecast shows a little bit of an increase in terms of the budget, the overall budget number, we should proceed somewhat cautiously before we get any big ideas about lots of additional spending or lots of additional tax cuts or lots of additional whatever, that it sounds like the forecast would be consistent, limited growth, but nothing exponential.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I would always recommend caution when reading the forecast numbers, and forecasts are forecasts, not money in the bank. And so at the time when we release the next forecast, we will explain if whatever changes there are, and there may be changes in any number of taxes, that some of which may have to do with economic factors. Some are going to be likely technical corrections. Some may be due to timing. We'll explain that, and so hopefully, at that point, you'll have explanations that will help guide you at that point about whether we're talking about resources that have gone up, resources that have gone down, resources that we expect to carry forward, resources that we expect not to carry forward.
Okay. Thank you.
So back a little bit to the U.S. economy. As I said, the labor market is tightening at the U.S. level. And we do expect that tightening labor market, together with improvements in productivity, to put upward pressure on wages. And I'll talk about that a little bit more in a minute, too. So as I said, the U.S. forecast calls for real GDP to accelerate, but at lower levels than what we had expected prior. As we reported in the January Revenue and Economic Update, the 2015 outlook for U.S. economic growth has improved somewhat since we released the November forecast. Consumer confidence is higher. Business confidence is higher. And consumer confidence in particular has been buoyed by lower gasoline prices, which have fallen by almost $1.50 per gallon since June. And we discussed that a little bit in the January Revenue and Economic Update. So the IHS macro forecast is a forecast. It depends on a number of things. It does assume and depends on stronger labor market conditions translating into improvements in those household formations, those disappointing household formations I talked about, boosting that housing recovery. It also depends on a rebound in productivity. It depends on a smooth transition in monetary policy from the Federal Reserve's accommodative monetary policy to more normal monetary policy. It does depend on federal fiscal policy not detracting from economic growth. And global economic growth can provide both an upside and downside risk to the U.S. forecast, meaning that resolution of international economic and political risks will improve U.S. growth and exacerbated risks will slow U.S. growth. So moving to the chart on the unemployment chart, the one that's titled Minnesota's Economic Expansion Continues, let me talk a bit about Minnesota's economy. This chart shows the headline unemployment rates for Minnesota in the U.S. Minnesota's unemployment rate dropped to 3.9% in October, which is what we presented at the November forecast. It's now at 3.7%. It's the fifth lowest among states. And now the unemployment rate in Minnesota matches the low point of the previous economic expansion. So if you look at the 2002 to 2007 economic expansion, the unemployment rate we're at now matches the low point there. So it kind of gives you an idea of where we are in this expansion. That doesn't mean that the unemployment rate cannot go further. In 1999, it got as low as 2.5%. The official aggregate unemployment rate can mask important differences between groups. However, the labor market improvements have been fairly broad-based in Minnesota, with unemployment having fallen across age, gender, and racial cohorts. Another reason that we, besides differences between groups of workers, another reason that we drill down below that headline unemployment rate is because the official rate can understate labor market underutilization or slack in the labor market. But these alternative measures of labor market slack have fallen as well. So the number of officially long-term unemployed is less than half what it was in 2010. The number of marginally attached workers is very close to pre-recession levels. The rate of involuntary part-time unemployment, while still above pre-recession levels, has fallen sharply as well. So if you add all of those additional types of labor market underutilization or underemployment, the unemployment rate for Minnesota comes to 8.8%, which is well below its pre-recession peak of 4.2%. It's well below the U.S. rate and that of many other states. In addition, leading labor market indicators for Minnesota look positive. So fewer people are being laid off, as measured by initial claims for unemployment insurance. The average work week of private sector employees and job vacancy rates are both high relative to history. So it looks like employers are not laying people off. They're increasing hours for the people they have. They're posting job vacancies. And so they're doing more with the workers they have. Turning to the next slide on slower wage growth. Nevertheless, slower wage growth is expected for Minnesota. So the wage pressures that we would expect to occur at a time when the labor market is tightening as much as it appears to be, have not yet emerged, and the growth that we forecast in February has not yet materialized. So nominal wage income grew 3.1% in 2013, and Now we think that wage income in 2014 is going to grow, will have grown 3.9%, which is below the 5% we expected in February. We do still expect acceleration in wage growth, so we do expect that this labor market tightening is going to bring wages up, but we're expecting it at a lower level than what we had forecast in February. So the lower U.S. forecast and reduced Minnesota wage growth forecast both influence our revenue forecast, particularly in the next biennium. Moving to the next table, showing tax receipts for 14, the tax forecast for the current biennium, FY14-15. Commissioner Franz noted that total revenues for 2014-15 are now forecast to be $279 million, or 7.7%, more than the February forecast adjusted for law changes. Actual tax revenues at the close of 2014, so actual tax revenues at the close of the fiscal year that ended June 30th, 2014, were primarily responsible for the change. So fiscal year 14 ended with tax revenues $189 million above the February forecast, adjusted for law changes, accounting for 70% of the forecast change in tax revenues for the biennium. The individual income tax shows the largest dollar amount change, $289 million. Of that, $194 million is due to higher than forecast income tax revenues at the close of fiscal year 14. And we believe this change is largely due to higher than expected tax liability in tax year 13. So to sum, the biennial change, the forecast change for the current biennium for revenues is largely an income tax story. It is largely an income tax at the close of fiscal year 14 story, which is largely a tax year 13 liability story. So almost all of this is in the rearview mirror, is what I'm saying. But note that this is based on an estimate of tax year 13 liability. When we prepare a November forecast, we don't know the actual tax liability for the tax year associated with the fiscal year that just ended. So we have to estimate it based on information we have on hand. So that estimate we will adjust and change for the next forecast. Sales tax revenues are now expected to exceed end-of-session estimates for the current biennium by $46 million. And the corporate tax is forecast to bring in less than the prior year estimate. So let me finish with just a bit about revenues for fiscal year 16-17, the next biennium, which are expected to grow, as you can see from the next the following chart. Total general fund revenues for the next biennium are now forecast to be $41.88 billion, 6.4% above forecast fiscal year 14-15 revenue. So this is a biennium-to-biennium comparison. This is largely an individual income tax story. Together, the individual income and general sales taxes account for almost all of the projected biennial growth in total tax revenues. The individual income tax shows the largest increase, growing 5.5% in 2016 and 6.3% in 2017, contributing 77% of forecast tax revenues. And that concludes my notes about the economy and revenues. If you have no questions, I'll turn it over to Budget Director Kelly.
Well, let me start if I can. A couple of questions. First, other than the great work of all the state legislators, putting that aside, what's the economic reason for Minnesota having that much of a lower unemployment rate versus every other state? I assume one of the states that's higher than us would be, or lower than us in terms of unemployment, would be North Dakota for unique reasons. So why us?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, there are some factors that are fundamental to Minnesota's economy that I can talk about here, and some factors that are more circumstantial. So the factors that are fundamental to Minnesota's economy that help Minnesota's economy perform better than some other states are a well-educated workforce. We do have high levels of education, both high school and college attainment, than many other states. And the fact that Minnesota has a very diverse economic base. with diverse industries represented. So if you look at the distribution of Minnesota's employment across industrial sectors, and look at that picture, it looks very similar to the U.S. economy, meaning that Minnesota has almost as diverse an economic base, industrial base, as the U.S. economy does. That kind of diversity helps a state economy be more resilient through economic downturns and buoys the economy in economic expansions. So, for instance, if you have a lot of different industries represented in your labor market, then if one industry is contracting and releasing workers, another industry might be expanding and be able to pick those workers up. It also makes the state be an attractive place for people to relocate, because if they relocate here for a job and that job doesn't work out, there may be another place for them to get work. So it's the difference between being a one company town and being a state that has a lot of different players, a lot of different industries that benefit from one another. In terms of the economic recovery, another thing that helped Minnesota recover more quickly from the Great Recession than the United States as a whole and many other states was that one of the industries that we are overrepresented in relative to the United States is healthcare services. And that's a sector that grew during the recovery, and we benefited from that growth and adding jobs in that sector. Another thing that helps us relative to some other upper Midwest states is that Minnesota's economy is relatively overrepresented in durable and non-durable manufacturing relative to the United States, but less so than many of the other upper Midwest states. And so we were not harmed as much by contractions in manufacturing, and then in particular non-durable manufacturing, which in Minnesota is dominated by food manufacturing, grew through the expansion. So those are workforce, economic diversity are two things that I think helps Minnesota outperform other places. Another thing that's happening right now, though, is sort of this that's putting pressure on our downward pressure on our unemployment rate is that we do have a tightening of the labor market that is due to being in an economic expansion and having put a lot of people back to work during the expansion. We also have demographic change that is lowering labor force growth, and that's happening at the same time as we're in this economic expansion, so the aging of the workforce. And third, we're in a region of the country surrounded on one side by states that have low unemployment rate, in particular North Dakota, low unemployment rate, high state GDP growth. So it's not just North Dakota, but North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa all have, and Nebraska all have low unemployment rates and high growth as well. And so it's kind of a perfect storm for pushing our unemployment rate down, is the structural factors in addition to these more circumstantial factors.
Okay. A couple of other things. Just jumping to a different topic. You've talked about how household formation is stagnant and the consequent, if not retraction, lack of growth in the housing market, which makes sense. But what's the reason for the lack of household formation? Well, because I don't think that's something that's ever come up before that I can recall.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, so at the U.S. level, I said that we got this news last March that household formations were lower than expected and were lower than the historical trend. And the things that were cited as reasons for that were partly the aging of the population, which we knew about, but I don't think it was expected that would decrease mobility as much as it does. So people who are older tend not to move as much. And so aging the population decreases mobility. So that was one factor. Expectations of immigration were lower. There's also a factor of people who are younger and who are of the right age to be separating from their parents, for instance, and starting households, have less of an appetite for buying houses than was expected. So those things have all contributed to that slower household formation.
Okay, and then lastly, a couple of our members have questions, but I guess the issue, not just here but nationally, is what the reason is for the stagnant wage growth. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be at least from what I read, the big economic question, which so far I haven't read an answer to, so maybe you can offer the answer.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, you are right that that is the big economic question. And if you read transcripts from members of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve, including the chair, Chair Yellen, this is something they focus on, is how much slack is there in the labor market? And as unemployment rates comes down, why aren't wages going up? Wages are going up, but why isn't wage growth higher than what we've seen? Several explanations that are being floated and are being examined are one that does have to do with aging of the workforce again, that people who are aging out of the workforce and retiring, they tend to retire at higher salaries than the people coming in have. So when you replace older workers with younger workers, that tends to be this experience shift that lowers wages in general, lowers average wages. So that's one thing that could be happening. Another is that in aggregate, the jobs that have been added during the recession are added at lower wage jobs than the jobs that were lost. The jobs that were added during the expansion are lower wage jobs than those that were lost during the recession, and so that's created a shift as well. Another thing that has been floated as an idea that may indeed have been happening is that employers didn't lower wages during the recession as much as you might have expected, given how bad the economic conditions were. And so maybe one of the things that happened was people laid people off, and then they didn't bring wages down for the people who were still working as much as they might have. And so now that the expansion is occurring and the labor market is tightening, they don't have as much room to raise wages as you might expect. So sort of there's this lag where they didn't come down that much, and so maybe they can't come up as much yet. We do see some bits of evidence of wages starting to push up. So we do still expect it to happen. But there have been some. It's been an unusual thing to observe.
But if a reason is the demographics, that doesn't change then. In terms of a younger workforce replacing an older workforce.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, if that's the dominant explanation, then you're right that there would be more of a lag. But you still, in a place like Minnesota, where the labor market slack is being taken up and the unemployment rate is low, you still would expect those younger workers to have some bargaining power now with regard to what wages they get. It's also very important in a tight labor market like what we have now to look at the pockets of unemployment that we do have and the populations that aren't working yet. We still have some involuntary part-time workers, so people who are working part-time would prefer to be full-time. The African-American unemployment rate is significantly above the white unemployment rate in Minnesota. We do still have some long-term unemployed, and we have, if you look at a map of the state and look at unemployment rates across the state, we do still have some pockets of unemployment. So pulling those people into the workforce and those people onto payrolls is going to be important for Minnesota going forward.
Okay, thank you. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doctor, it's been a while since I've taken an economics class in college, but I'm trying to kind of reacquaint myself with some of the terms. Gross domestic product, or a real gross domestic product, is that kind of the art of, or using that term, is that the best definition to use when we're talking about economic growth or economic vitality? You know, you hear the words about gross national product, maybe a gross state product if there is one, or should we look at an adjusted real GDP where it accommodates the expense of making that income as well? And is that something that you've looked at in order to maybe have a better definition of this?
Mm-hmm. Senator, members of the committee, Mr. Chairman, that's a great question. So we do use real GDP because it measures U.S. output, and it's easily comparable across countries, and it's comparable across time. But Importantly, just like with the headline unemployment rate, economists like to use these aggregates to look across, to compare across jurisdictions and across time. But often, aggregates and averages mask important differences under the under that headline or that level. So, looking at some of one of the things we try to do in our explanations, both in the forecast document and in our revenue and economic updates, is to try to explain why real GDP may have changed and what are the contributions are, so that you can see, for instance, I talked about the change from February to November, consumer spending and business investment and household housing investment were all things that contributed to that change. So I think looking at the reasons for the change can give you more information than just looking at a change in real GDP. Another, and combining that information with information about prices, for instance, and cost of production, that can be very helpful. Looking at things like total cost of employment or wages plus benefits can be helpful. Another limitation of looking at real GDP is that we are here, I'm often here to talk about revenues, state tax revenues, and there's quite a big difference, big leap from real GDP to Minnesota tax revenues. So there's often a leap, a disconnect between real GDP and the state economy. So the U.S. economy can be growing at different rates than the state economy. And then there can be a leap between state economic growth and what's happening in revenues, because for a variety of reasons, that some of the things that can affect revenues, for instance, capital gains, aren't measured in GDP, whether it's U.S. or state. So I guess my best answer at this point is it's certainly helpful to look at alternative measures, especially when we're talking about revenues.
Senator.
Sure. I would imagine it might be difficult to make predictions because there's so many economic factors that are outside of our control. Mm. If you look at the price of fuel and gasoline, a lower demand on the product mm-hmm. with an increased supply being developed in the continental United States, that's going to change the revenue stream on the taxes that come from those sales. And I would like to hope that the prices of, not services, but goods would go down with the price of gas going down. Mm-hmm. We all were alarmed when gas shot up to $4 a gallon a few years ago and all of the food prices went up. I'm waiting for the food prices to go down now that we have a dollar and a half off the gallon of gas. I haven't quite seen that yet, but maybe there's other factors that I just don't see. One of the other questions I had is you made mention of the healthcare industry growing during the time of the recession, and I was wondering if there's any obvious industry in the state of Minnesota that has not only benefited but have weakened that we should be attentive to in your analysis.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, members of the committee. If you look at the change in the number of jobs during the expansion, so the recovery of jobs lost during the recession, almost every industry grew during that expansion in Minnesota. So that, I think, is a testament to that broad economic base, where we're sort of firing on almost all cylinders. And we did recover the number of jobs lost in the recession 8 months ahead of the United States. The two industries that I'm picturing right now that lost jobs during that same time period, one was government, in particular federal government. So during that time, the federal government, remember there was a shutdown, there was sequestration, so a lot of some federal government jobs were lost during that time. Minnesota lost some of those. Minnesota is not one of the states that's particularly vulnerable to a federal government contraction because we're not a big federal government state. We're not Virginia or Maryland, for instance. Another, if I remember correctly, that was negative or zero was that the industrial sector that includes the media, includes print press, and that's a sector that has been has been losing jobs. Now, if you look over the last year and look at year-over-year employment gains, one of the one industry, if I remember correctly, the one industry industrial sector that is negative in jobs year-over-year is financial services. So that's one that I would – it's an important sector in Minnesota. It's one of the sectors that adds to our diversity, and it's one that I'm keeping my eye on, that I would like to see that go from a negative to a positive.
And Mr. Chair, one last question. When it came to your analyzing unemployment and job growth, the jobs that you were defining, are those full-time jobs, 40-hour, or are they 29 hours that a lot of companies have adjusted to accommodate the expenses of Obamacare, or are they part-time? Could you give me an idea of, in your definition for the purposes of presentation, mm-hmm. what does jobs mean?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, Senator, members of the committee, so when we talk about unemployment, the line graph that we have of the unemployment rate, that is based on asking people, do you have a job? And so that will include both part-time and full-time jobs. So so that number masks that difference if there's been a shift between part-time and full-time work. The number I talked about of people who are involuntary part-time, these are people who are not counted as unemployed because they're working part-time. But when asked, would you prefer to have a full-time job? Are you looking for a full-time job? They say yes. And so that number is often considered a part of labor market slack because we could pull those people into full-time. That would be helpful for the economy. There's sort of potential. There's potential there. But that number has come down significantly, too. It's still above pre-recession levels, but not that much. But there's still some slack there. When I was talking about industrial sectors and job growth and recovering the jobs since the recession, that is all jobs, so it includes part-time and full-time. So that brings up another important point, that to say that Minnesota has fully recovered the jobs lost during the recession is not to say that everyone in Minnesota is as well off as we would have been had the recession not occurred, because some people are working part-time when they prefer to be full-time, and some are working at lower wages than they would have had we just continued on trend, and our population has grown in the meantime.
Senator Westrum.
Mr. Chair, question, you talked about the neighboring states with lower unemployment rate than us, Minnesota being near the top of unemployment, but particularly North Dakota. Mm-hmm. We're seeing the lowering of crude oil prices dramatically dropping, a welcomed relief to many of us filling vehicles, but we're buying heating oil or propane. But how does that affect the economics potentially? And in my district, I run across people on a weekly basis probably that are working out in the oil fields. Either their business has shifted and sent crews out there, or they themselves are finding employment while they live in Minnesota. They are traveling back and forth as that is their new job. Do we anticipate a slowing and an effect for our state with the drop in crude oil prices, or is it too early to tell?
Mr. Chairman, Senators, falling oil prices has been, just like with the wage stagnation, has been a fascinating issue to watch in the United States, where we are now much more of a producer than we used to be. And so the impact is positive for consumers. It creates a consumer dividend for those of us who can shift spending away from gasoline toward other things. So it's positive for consumers, but it has more of an impact on the production side in the U.S. than it used to before the U.S. was such a high producer. So what I read and I hear about happening in North Dakota is that the lower prices will potentially slow some rig development, and so some of the heavy construction, and it may reduce some production. But that we can't say much yet. I don't think I can say much yet, because one of the things that's also happening is this is happening during the winter, and North Dakota is up north, and so there's some weather factors that could be affecting production too. And so I think that I want to hold off and see what happens, not look at some of the month-to-month data, but see what happens as time goes on. So how is it going to affect Minnesota? First of all, we don't have a lot of data yet on how the oil boom in North Dakota did affect Minnesota, the Minnesota economy and Minnesota employment. We think that it has brought put some downward pressure on the unemployment rate. You've certainly heard of people working there. I've certainly heard of people working there. The state demographer has looked at the movement of people from Minnesota to North Dakota, and while that movement is a big, makes a dent in North Dakota's labor force because they have a small labor force, it's not such a big part of our labor force because we're bigger. So that shift is felt less here than it is there. So lower oil prices, what are they going to do to Minnesota economy? I think it takes a little pressure off of our unemployment rate, but the fact that we are this diverse economy not completely dependent on that one industry means that I don't think it's going to have a noticeable impact.
Okay, thanks. And Senator Westerman, if you'll just allow me to ask for what I think is a slight correction. When I asked about the unemployment rates and you cited the other states, I don't think you said that those other states other than North Dakota had a lower unemployment rate than Minnesota. That our unemployment rate is still lower than South Dakota, Nebraska, Iowa?
And Mr. Chairman, yes. I was going to correct that, but I also didn't find my notes on those state unemployment rates. So we are definitely higher than North Dakota for unemployment, the unemployment rate. But I don't have South Dakota, Iowa with me at the moment. So I, maybe after Budget Director Kelly has a chance to talk, I can find it.
Okay,
but
great.
My intuition was the same, that it's not that they're all lower than us, except North Dakota.
Ms. Kelly.
Great. For the record, I'm Margaret Kelly, Assistant Commissioner at Minnesota Management and Budget, and I am going to speak to the slides on the spending side of the equation. Beginning with forecast spending has been reduced in the current and next biennium. So the table on this page speaks to our current forecast for spending compared to our earlier estimates, both for the current biennium and the next biennium. Spending is reduced in both biennia, $249 million lower than earlier estimates for 14-15 and $502 million lower than earlier estimates for 16 and 17. And much of the billion-dollar forecast that we have to deal with here is a result of these spending changes. And as you can see from the table, Health and Human Services is the big story here and why spending is lowered, and much of that is all about Medicaid. And I'll talk about that in a minute, but first I'm just going to go through some of the smaller numbers. K-12 enrollment continues to grow, but just not as much as we had anticipated in the earlier projections end of session. And so total pupil units estimates relative to the forecast last February are down. It's still growing overall, but $50 and $60 million of saving each biennium. Property tax aids and credits are just slightly different than what we had earlier estimated, and it's based on actual property tax refund payments being lowered in the current fiscal year, and that rolls forward into the future years. And it's offset in 16 and 17 by higher renter property tax refunds and the targeted homeowner property tax refunds, slightly higher in the out years. On the debt service line, we saw some reductions in the current biennium, and that is due to market conditions at the time we made our bond sale, lowered our costs more than we had thought they would be. All other spending, that number in the current biennium is higher than we usually see an upward, we don't typically see an upward adjustment of that amount. But a part of the 2011 budget solution was a loan from the closed landfill trust fund that we began paying back in this biennium. The repayment schedule for principal and lost interest earnings was written into law, and 51 of the $65 million increase is due to significantly higher than forecast investment earnings that would have accrued to the trust fund had the money not been loaned to the general fund. So basically, we took the money out of the fund when interest rates and the stock market was very low, and we paid it back when it was very high. And so there was enormous growth over that period of time that the general fund needed to repay per law.
Ms. Kelly, sorry for interrupting that. This might be a little bit unfair and premature, but I don't know if it's directed to yourself or to the commissioner. How is that going to be reflected in next week's budget?
Mr. Chair and members, the repayment is assumed in the forecast, and so there does not need to be any adjustment made in the budget for that.
Okay.
Going back to Health and Human Services line on the budget, there are two primary changes in our Medicaid forecast that account for the 2.2 and 3.4 million reductions in cost, and it's rates and it's enrollment. In terms of managed care rates for 15, they came in much lower than we had assumed in the previous forecast, and that was due to population changes, or who enrolled in MA, along with lower health care spending. The largest change was in families with children, which had been assumed to see a 2% increase in rates and actually saw a 4% decrease in rates. And the ratio of adults to children was lower than expected, and that drove our rates down. In terms of enrollment, the MA basic care total enrollment was relatively unchanged from forecast to forecast. It was up only slightly, 0.9%, but it followed a different pattern than we had previously expected, and this pattern change is what caused spending reductions in the forecast. First, more people enrolled as adults without children than had been previously estimated, a 25% increase over end-of-session estimates. And this group is no cost to the state. It's 100% paid by the federal government. So growth in enrollment there did not impact the state budget. And fewer people enrolled as disabled individuals and as families with children than we had previously assumed. And those populations do impact the state budget. So if you look on the chart on the very next page with the bar graphs, comparing the two outer bar graphs, they're all gray in your copy, I'm sure. The two-hour bar graphs show the change in enrollment from one estimate to the next. So what we had assumed at the end of session forecast for fiscal year 15 compared to what we're assuming in this forecast for fiscal year 15. A very slight growth in enrollment. But the difference is in who enrolled in the program. And so the second bar graph there is families with children, and we saw 20,000 fewer people enrolled. Next is the elderly and disabled, and another 7.8 thousand people fewer enrolled. And that is what yielded the savings. The growth in enrollment came from adults without kids and did not have an impact on the state budget in fiscal year 15. And these enrollment patterns roll forward into 16, 17, 18, and 19. And so that is why we're seeing the savings in this forecast. The next piece of the story, or the next page, is the fiscal year 18 and 19 planning estimates. And it's important to keep in mind that these estimates for the out biennium are just that. They're planning. They're a little more risky than the estimates that we have for the current biennium, a higher degree of uncertainty. It's projection based on current law moving forward. If we continued our spending per what law directs, if the revenue came in as the law directs, it is not a budget, and so it does not indicate whether our budget is out of balance or not, but just what the cost of our current patterns would be. So you can see from this chart that the revenue growth exceeds expenditure growth and showing a structural balance moving forward, a growing structural balance in fiscal years 17, 18, and 19. This is good news for the state. We've not seen this level of positive structural balance in a while. We do put on this chart a comparison of inflation. We don't include inflation overall in the forecast. There is some inflationary growth on the revenue side. There's a small amount of inflationary growth on the spending side in our healthcare forecast. Overall, we've just taken a crude estimate of inflation here. It is not precise, but if you applied inflation to the spending side of the budget, the value of that would be $1.7 billion in fiscal year 19, slightly outstripping the structural balance that we have. But overall, this forecast is a good news story for the state. We deposited money in the reserves. We have a positive balance in the current biennium and the next biennium. And our projections looking forward are looking good as well.
Ms. Kelly, if I could ask about the inflation issue, has there been any discussion? You know, we've increased the budget reserve by increments. And I have to admit, at the risk of quoting myself from past years, I think first year I chaired this committee in 2003, I started raising the issue of inflation not being in the budget forecast, recognizing that the consequence would be that, you know, we wouldn't have as much of a surplus, obviously. Has there been any discussion, if you could say internally, on whether or not to gradually put inflation back in the budget forecast? I guess I should direct that to the commissioner.
Mr. Chair, members, there is continuing discussion. I think one of the things that we constantly look at the budget process, the forecasting process, to make it as accurate and as much detail as possible for you, the policymakers, to be able to make your decisions. And I know that the governor and the legislature, this is really a decision for you all in terms of how do you want the budget to be presented in a way that accurately projects what's going to happen and also accurately takes into account those things like inflation. So we think about it, we talk about it a lot, but ultimately this is a decision that you and the policymakers really have to decide is how you want to budget with these ideas in mind and whether or not you want to make any changes.
Okay. And I'm forced to admit that removing inflation from the budget forecast was a 2002 Senate initiative. And I can elaborate on that privately. Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Kelly, you said that the inflationary numbers was a crude attempt. So when you say that, I'm trying to get a sense of exactly how crude is it. A percent equally applied across all spending, or do you actually within that kind of rough estimating, do you go through and look at some budget areas are a little, the growth actually usually comes in a little higher, some lower. So how have you come up with these numbers?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonhoff, we simply apply an inflationary factor against all spending. So
thank you.
No precision.
Thank you.
Ms. Kelly, obviously you factored federal spending into the spending side. Any sense as to what you see over the next several years? I mean, you made a reference to some of the healthcare spending. Anything else that would have a significant impact in terms of what we're doing?
Mr. Chair, the forecast we're doing here is just federal, is just general fund, so it does not reflect any change in federal funding. We did release our consolidated fund statement a week or so ago. And that shows changes across the board in all funds, federal funds, environmental funds, healthcare access funds. So clearly, from an all funds perspective, we're looking at a deficit in the healthcare access fund in the current and next biennium. There is, in the consolidated fund statement, a growth in federal revenues coming into the state, and I'm not sure about detail beyond that.
Other question, Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A follow-up question to my earlier question, maybe directed at the commissioner. If we were to consider putting inflation back into the spending side, would it be done? Would it be proposed to be done the way that the estimate is done, where it's just one percentage applied across all, or would you actually be able to go in and drill down and more accurately put an estimate of the way inflation has affected that budget category. Because they're really, that's one of the reasons why I've never been sure where I stood on this issue, because inflation does affect each spending category differently.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, what we have done in the past when we did have inflation in the forecast was we simply applied a general inflationary factor against areas of the budget where we should be, where we could be assuming inflation, except for those areas where it might differ from a more general number. So, for example, healthcare typically has a higher inflation than other areas of spending. So we could be as precise as you directed us to be, but in the past what we've done is identified those areas of spending that have a higher rate of inflation and applied it there, and for the rest used a general rate of inflation.
Thank you.
Other questions for Ms. Kelly? If I can get back, Dr. Kolomakidis, if you don't mind. I'd like to get back to the wage stagnation. You indicated that some of that was possibly employers not lowering wages to the extent that might have been anticipated in the recession. But that's not a Minnesota perspective. That's just a national theory. Is that fair?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that's right. That's one of the ideas that's being looked at the national level, because the slower growth of wages is not a Minnesota specific phenomenon. It is something that has happened nationally.
So, is there anything that would relate in the particular to Minnesota in terms of lower wage growth? And last year we increased the minimum wage, for instance. Does that reflect in higher wage growth to any discernible extent?
Mr. Chairman, members, I think it's too early for us to have seen an impact in the data of any change in the minimum wage. Also, at the time the minimum wage was raised, we're in an expansion and in this time of tightening labor market, and so there were other pressures for wages to go up. So it would take some careful analysis to try to figure out going back if there has been an effect, but we don't even really have the data yet, I don't think, to know that. So I'm not seeing the fact that wage growth did not materialize to the extent expected in Minnesota, I don't think is a Minnesota specific thing. I think it's just what's happening nationally.
So the simple inference is there's nothing we as a legislature can really do about that. We're just along for the economic ride.
Mr. Chairman, members, I don't know that the legislature is along for the ride, because there are things that the legislature can do to try to remove barriers to people entering the labor market, for instance. So it's less in terms of wages, wage growth. It's not clear to me what policy there is that you would do that would change that.
Yeah, we can do something in terms of people entering the labor market, either by way of education, or we could, as a state government, triple the the state government employment force. Mm-hmm. So there are things that a legislature arguably could do or could not do. But in terms of wage growth, we're not going to be able to necessarily have an impact on that.
Mr. Chairman, members, what I think is happening in the state of Minnesota is what's happening in the rest of the country, which is employers are trying to sort this out. In many sectors, in specific sectors and in specific parts of the state, there are employers that are facing this pressure on wages, and they're trying to figure out to what extent do I need to raise wages in order to attract workers to my firm? Can I raise wages given other conditions? How much demand is there? I think that we're in a transition time when each individual employer is facing these decisions, and some of them are raising wages in order to attract people. So I think the employers of Minnesota are hard at work trying to figure out to what extent, what their next offers are going to be.
In an area that you didn't comment on and recognize sitting here in St. Paul, Minnesota, there's certainly nothing we're going to do about this, but what kind of international pressures exist, and to what extent do we find the United States and Canada as kind of an economic island, with what's happening in Russia or any other place? What's the consequence to the American economy and at some point a consequence to our economy?
Mr. Chairman, members, certainly, as I mentioned and we talked about at the time of the November forecast, the global economy always poses risks, and in this particular juncture it feels like it's posing almost equal upside and downside risks. If issues are resolved abroad, that creates benefits for the U.S. economy. If the European Union, for instance, stagnates and continues to do poorly, that's going to reflect poorly on the U.S. economy. However, Minnesota's trading partners, the largest trading partners for Minnesota, are Canada and Mexico, and so as you mentioned, we are dependent on the U.S. economy. So a lot of our economy is tied to the U.S. economy. But in terms of specific demand for our products in Minnesota, we're more closely tied to the rest of North America than we are to Russia or the EU or China.
Okay, thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, if you don't mind, I can answer your question about the neighboring unemployment rates now. So we are in this neighborhood of low unemployment rates. Minnesota at 3.7% has the 5th lowest rate. And if you look at the lowest 6 unemployment rates among states, they're all but one is in our neighborhood, is in the upper Midwest. So North Dakota is the lowest at 2.7. Nebraska is at 3.1. South Dakota is at 3.3. So all of those are below Minnesota. Minnesota is at 3.7. And Iowa is at 4.3.
So I was wrong. In fact, the surrounding states, we comprise the lowest states.
Yes.
But we are a higher rate than those other states.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. So, and actually, I misspoke. So 1, 2, 3, 4, of the top, of the lowest 5, 4 of them are the upper Midwest. Iowa's a couple states below, but a couple states down. But yes, I guess my point is we're in this low unemployment neighborhood, and we neighbor states with lower population than us. And so when those states are growing, like North Dakota is and South Dakota, Nebraska, Iowa all do in good ag years, that draws workers out of our state.
And apparently we don't do as well as Wisconsin relative to either professional or college football, but we beat them on unemployment. Is that – I take it that's correct.
Mr. Chairman, our unemployment rate is lower than Wisconsin's. That's correct.
Sarah Thomas-Soniger.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Salt, does population have anything to do with the unemployment rate? Because there's no people in North Dakota or South Dakota. And then how many of them actually work in Minnesota? And is that counted as the unemployment rate in South Dakota and North Dakota?
Mr. Chairman, Senators, the in an area that has low population, small changes can affect these rates in dramatic ways. And so if you have a small population, it doesn't take, I guess a way to put it, it doesn't take that many jobs to have a low unemployment rate. So that's why low population places often have low unemployment rates. Not always, because you can have low population places where nobody's working. But so population does matter. And then your other question was, I can't remember the second question.
To the people who live in North and South Dakota and work in Minnesota, I imagine that counts as part of their unemployment rate also. But
you know, Mr. Chairman, members, it depends on the data you're looking at. So for the unemployment rate numbers that I showed you, that the line graph, that's a survey, and so it depends if you have moved to the state, and they call you in that state and say, "Do you have a job?" You're going to get counted as employed in that state, as part of the employment rate in that state. If you're temporarily there and you come back here and we call you when you're here, you're going to get counted as, you know, a part of the employment rate for Minnesota. So it depends on whether you're talking about permanent location relocations versus temporary, and whether you're talking about the unemployment rate, which is this household survey, versus the jobs numbers, which are a payroll survey of employers. So it depends.
Mr. Chairman, so in other words, in apples to apples, you should be comparing Minnesota to another state with 4 or 5 million people as opposed to a state with 750,000 people. That would be actually more fair if you were going to rank them.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm not sure about that. I'd have to think more carefully about how the population and the labor force affects these numbers. So I'm gonna not answer that without thinking about it more carefully.
Okay, Commissioner, another issue that we haven't you touched on was the budget reserve, listen to you. I think you're including the cash flow account in that aggregate number. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct. The cash reserve, the cash account is included as part of the $1.3 billion reserve.
So the pure reserve is about, what, 950-ish? Because the cash flow full funding is 350, I think.
Mr. Chair, yeah, the current budget reserve is 994 right now, the technical reserve account. And the cash flow added to that gets us to the $1.3 billion total number that we use available cash and reserve.
And so what are your projections in terms of the out years as to a reserve? Have you done those? I think you had at some point.
We have not at this point in the forecast. We simply forecast a reserve balance going forward. So depending upon the law, the reserve, the surplus, forecast surplus in November, we would add to that by law, but we would not add to that other than by a reserve balance being available in the November forecast.
But I thought I had seen something that reflected, I don't know, Mr. Nauman, maybe you would.
Mr. Chair, I might be able to be a little
bit. You showed me something at some point.
I might be able to be a little helpful. Based on the law that was amended last year, the department on January 15th produces a new report, and in that report they give us a percentage of revenue and translate that into a projected number, essentially a new target. And for the 14-15 biennium, that number was about $1.99 billion. And if I'm reading the report correctly, when we get to next year's November forecast, we will be in the 16-17 biennium. And at that point, the report is projecting numbers of about 2.2, I think it's 2.166 or in that neighborhood, as the new target number. But that doesn't mean that's what the reserve would be. The reserve would be, if there is a surplus, it would be 33% of that projected surplus.
That's what I was kind of grasping. I wasn't quite sure what I'd seen or not seen. So,
and if you don't mind, Mr. Chairman, I just want to clarify that the report, that's the recommended amount. So it's the target. So it's not a projection of what the reserve will be.
And so the recommended amount still remains that roughly $2 billion figure, but we're starting to inch our way toward that. So I think that was recommended through the Budget Trends Commission, which was I know I authored the legislation establishing it, but it was chaired by, Mr. Kudrowski and I think Mr. Goodnow, wasn't it?
Mr. Chairman, yes, that's correct. And I was on that commission, and the Professor Stinson, my predecessor, and Matt Shepner, who's on our staff, and John Pelliquin, who's on our staff, did work analyzing the volatility of state revenues for the State Budget Trends Study Commission, and that evolved into that methodology has been improved and changed to that informs the report that our office, MMB, now releases on January 15th of each year, making a recommendation for the budget reserve.
So this might be really premature, and I have no idea at that point who, of those of us around the table who's still going to be around, at least around here. But if we reach that optimum point of $2 billion, do we assume then that we backtrack in terms of the law we passed last year? I guess we kind of cross that bridge when we get to it. This is really a hypothetical and a hypothetical, so.
Mr. Chair, well, no, thank you. I love these hypotheticals, especially when I try not to answer them. But no, you raise an excellent point. So when you get to a target, what do you do when you get to the target? I mean, I think one of the keys you'd want to do at that point is look at the economy, the forecasting, where are we going, where have we been, and is this adequate for what we think might be coming? And I think that's part of the challenge of the forecasting is, you know, what's going to happen? Is this trend, the improving economy obviously is improving on a regular basis, but with a lot of cautions. How long is that going to happen, and when are we going to be looking at some not necessarily good times? So I think when we get to that target amount, I think it's important we'll all have to sit around and say, well, what does this mean? Do we need to add or subtract from that? I think that's a great question, and I hope we have a chance to answer that question in the future.
Whoever's here.
Yes.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks. So the subject of volatility of revenue, as well as building on Senator Bono's earlier question about you know, accounting for inflation in spending that might be different from budget category to budget category. Where can I find some of that data specific to the division that I have responsibility over? It's probably no secret, Mr. Pollard knows I'm pretty interested in the volatility of a particular source of revenue that affects transportation. I'm also very interested in how we analyze inflation in the transportation sector.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, so I'll defer to the Commissioner and Budget Director Kelly on the inflation and the spending side question. But in terms of revenue volatility, our analysis that showed that informs the budget reserve recommendation is in a report, our January 15th report, which is on our website. That is for general fund revenues only. So if you're specifically interested in something having to do with transportation, it's probably not considered there. But if you are on the forecasts and updates part of the MMB website, we have our current report, and we also, I think we may have a, or maybe forthcoming, a presentation on the methodology that we use that would show you the volatility of different particular revenue streams. In addition, I'll be giving testimony to the House Taxes Committee on Thursday of this week, where I'll talk about some of those things, so you can pick that up as well.
Mr. Chair and Senator and members, I guess I would also add, with respect to your question about, for example, targeted areas like transportation, for example, I know that Mr. Pollard can put you in contact with some of the information we're doing to develop some more specific targeted forecasting of those revenues. As you well know, that area has become a little bit more difficult to do these days. It used to be in the past, it was fairly simple to project gasoline taxes, and that was just they kept going up, right? But now with this new dynamic and the world politics the way that they are and the world output on oil, that's become a much more difficult thing. So we have some information we can share with you on the transportation side of that too, I think.
Sure.
And I'll just suggest motor vehicle sales tax is much, much more volatile than was anticipated in 2001, 2002.
Exactly.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Commissioner, I understand you're new in the job, so someone else on your team might need to answer this question. But the legislature asked MMB to contract for a study to create a retirement system for low-wage workers, like a defined contribution plan. And that study was due January 15th. And I'm wondering if you could have someone explain why there's a delay, since it's already the 20th today, and when we might expect to see that study.
Mr. Chair and Senator members, I'm sure any delay is my fault because it's.
I already gave you a.
No, you gave me an out. But the truth of the matter is, we have a lot of reports due in January. We'll check on this particular one and get back to you right away and find out why it's not here and answer your question. And I think one of the issues for us is there are an inordinate number of reports due in January. But we'll double check on that one. I'll get back to you about why that one is late. But part of the problem is they have to educate me, and I'm not the fastest read around here. So there's a lot going on, but we'll get back to you as soon as we can on that.
And, Mr. Sure, Chairman, maybe you could get back to the entire Finance Committee the next time or time after we meet.
Yes, I'd be glad. Mr. Chair, yes, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Other questions for the Commissioner or Ms. Kelly or Dr. Kalamakidis? Okay, well, I appreciate your appearing in front of us. It certainly reinforces, Senator Lemmer made reference to his econ courses in college. This reinforces mine. So appreciate your spending time with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right.